Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So, listen. The housing market. I know. You thought it was getting better, didn't you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Conn Risdahl. Great to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It is the 1st of July today, and it is not every day, believe you me, that five government agencies, including the Federal Reserve and the FDIC among them, all come out with the same warning on the same day. Such was the case this morning, though, in what amounted to a collective look out to banks about homeowners' ability or perhaps inability to pay back their home equity lines of credit over the next couple of years. So tell me, you heard that anywhere else before? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the story.
Back in the early 2000s, right up to 2008, a lot of people took out lines of credit on their homes. This is where you can borrow money and use your house as collateral.
Anybody who had a breath, any home that was still standing, seemed to be eligible for one of these kinds of loans.
Nicholas Ritsinas is a senior lecturer in real estate at Harvard Business School. Now it's time to pay those loans back. Home equity lines of credit typically last 10 years, and starting now, 10 years have gone by. People now owe about $218 billion in home equity lines of credit, and $200 billion of it is due by 2018.
This is another bill coming due from the lending binge in the beginning of the 21st century.
Those bills will shock some people. Bob Piepergirdis is with the Comptroller of the Currency. He says borrowers who haven't been paying down their principal are going to have to start.
We're seeing that payments can go up 100 or even 200% or higher.
And given median incomes are lower than they were in 2007 and unemployment is higher, some people may run into trouble paying up. That presents risks for individuals and the economy.
There is some risk of repayment, so we're asking and expecting institutions to evaluate where their borrowers are.
Banks are getting ready. J.P. Morgan Chase says it's stocked up on reserves and is trying to let customers know their bills are going to go up. The largest lenders have reduced exposure by 20% through refinancing. Bob Davis is vice president at the American Bankers Association. He says consumers could follow the bank's lead.
So that's one thing consumers ought to do right now. If they know they have home equity lines of credit, they ought to look at the payments that they may have to make.
And he says refinancing is an option, but make sure your credit score will let you. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There are, in fact, second acts in American lives, and they are increasingly coming online. NBC's canceled sitcom Community is going to get a sixth season on Yahoo, because just like Hulu, Amazon, Netflix, and everybody else, Yahoo wants and needs original content. Tracy Samuelson has more.
Community was a ratings loser for NBC, and its future was always uncertain, a struggle that was mirrored in its final episode, as characters tried to save the community college the show was based around.
Did we just save Greendale?
No, no, you did not. Your school is still bankrupt, it is still unmarketable, and it is still on the permanent chopping block of anyone who has any say in its future.
Yeah? Well, around here, we call that Wednesday.
The show will help Yahoo beef up its video content, which CEO Marissa Meyer recently admitted has flopped in the past.
Literally, you know, last year we produced 86 different series.
Wow.
None of whom you've ever heard about, because it was just sort of a failed branding exercise.
It's a crowded marketplace out there, and unless you have something with an identity, people are not going to come to it.
Sam Craig is a professor at NYU's Stern School of Business. In order to draw people to the site, he says Yahoo needs strong, unique content, different from what Netflix and Hulu is offering. With Community will come the show's existing audience, which is small by broadcast standards, but passionate and wealthy, says Max Dawson, with the media consulting firm Frank N. Maggot Associates.
It beats out things like The Voice. It beats out the mega rating success story, Big Bang Theory, in attracting those rich viewers.
One network's trash is another tech company's treasure. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the Dow came oh so close to 17,000. But you know what, you guys? It is just a number. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you go to Aereo.com today, the company that used to let you stream broadcast television over the internet, there is a somewhat sad note from its CEO saying that in light of the Supreme Court ruling against them last week, they are going to take a break, refund subscribers, and think about what to do next. That ruling, though, bad as it was for Aereo, meant opportunity for its competitors. Mark Ely is the founder and CEO of one of them. It's called Simple TV. Mark, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Maybe the place to start is the technical difference between what it is that you do and what it was that Aereo did in the past tense.
Well, yeah, good question. And I think it really comes down to, you know, fundamentally where that TV content is captured. And in the case of Aereo, what they did, which was, you know, quite, you know, novel and really efficient, is capturing broadcast TV content from a central facility and then from there streaming it out to their subscribers. Mm-hmm. And the way Simple TV works, it's really different in the kind of the fact that we put the capture point in the user's home, and by doing so kind of really sit it in the same place that your traditional, you know, DVRs and place shifting technology sit. And it turns out that where you capture the content and who's doing it really makes all the difference.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but this is a business, a very lucrative business. So when the Supreme Court decided that Aereo case, were you kind of jumping up and down a little bit saying, this is very, very good for us?
Well, I think, you know, we had kind of mixed emotions about it, because I think on the one hand, what both Simple TV and Aereo really kind of were trying to do is deliver value to the consumer in the form of, you know, broadcast, live broadcast content that they can then get on all of their, you know, favorite devices. And, you know, anytime somebody's doing something innovative in the space, it's something to watch and something to really kind of be, you know, hopefully inspired by.
Did you design this? You must have designed your system with copyright law in mind.
We did, for sure. And, yeah, you know, when we started the company just over 3 years ago, about the same time that Aereo started, you know, we looked very much at that model. Can we put an antenna on a hill and deliver content, you know, over the internet? And I think at the time we looked at it and we thought, gee, that's great, but it probably is not the right way to go, at least the way we had thought about it. So our approach was to say, well, let's see what actually works with copyright law today. And the model of the DVR came up, which is kind of how we created our business. And so, you know, it was really very much in the context of, you know, what we think is sits squarely within fair use.
What is your risk profile, as it were, with some of the big companies who are trying to do some of these same things? Comcast comes to mind, right? And they are a gargantuan enterprise, and you are not.
We are not. Yeah, we are definitely the small guys. We're the David to the Comcast Goliath. But I think that what's really kind of fascinating is, you know, consumers, when they look at getting great television content on all of their different devices, they've got a couple of ways to go. One is they can pay the monthly toll for Comcast to get their, you know, range of services there. And there's no doubt there's tons of great content that you can get on cable. But what we see is a whole generation of people that are growing up on Netflix and Hulu and over-the-top streaming services, and, you know, see those kind of traditional networks, ABC, Fox, NBC, and others, as having great content, but they're not willing to necessarily buy those in a large bundle of other expensive channels that they don't so much care about. So we see ourselves really as kind of a supplement to the whole generation that's growing up on internet video.
Mark Ely is the CEO and founder of Simple TV. Mark, thanks a lot.
Kai, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
The charter school crowd is descending on Las Vegas this week for its annual convention, the National Charter Schools Conference. 4 days of networking, charter cheerleading, and political strategizing will no doubt ensue. For all the controversy charter schools create, though, you'd think there were more of them. At last count, they were about 6% of the entire public education system, about 2.5 million kids nationwide, mostly in low-income neighborhoods. They are growing, too, fueled by frustrated parents, deep-pocketed foundations, and politicians, all the while a lot of people having a lot of misperceptions about them. So Marketplace's Annie Baxter has our explainer.
This fall, Sejong Academy in St. Paul, Minnesota, will open its doors. It's a Korean immersion school for kids in kindergarten through sixth grade. A recent open house featured traditional Korean drumming. A big idea behind charters is to try out concepts that traditional public schools typically wouldn't, like focusing on outdoor programs or language immersion or even yoga. Sejong Academy's founders hope their curriculum will appeal to a big population of Korean adoptees in the Twin Cities. They're also hoping that non-Koreans will like learning another language. Board Chair Grace Lee is herself Korean-American.
I think, of course, a lot of schools will say, oh, you know, we promote global diversity, but how are they actually demonstrating that? Are they just having some ethnic food at a open house or something like that?
The real battle between charter schools and their traditional counterparts is far more pitched. Charter schools are public schools. They get taxpayer dollars, but they're run independently. And in many states, they're exempt from laws and regulations that apply to traditional public schools. Instead, the schools have to meet performance goals set out in their charters. It's easier to hire and fire teachers at charter schools and open and close the schools themselves.
That is also the secret ingredient to chartering, the fact that if the school is not performing well, it can be closed.
Nina Reese is president of the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. She says there are 6,500 charters operating in the U.S. Each year, about 500 new ones open and 150 or so close. The authorities who oversee the schools, called authorizers, might pull the plug due to low enrollment, poor performance, or financial mismanagement. But Dennis Van Rokel says that doesn't happen often enough. He's president of the nation's largest union, the National Education Association.
Too many of these charter schools, depending on state laws, really don't have that kind of accountability that you can close them down.
Van Rokel says in the meantime, charters leech money from traditional public schools.
They've really done students a disservice before anyone ever really notices what's going on.
Critics, who often include local school board members, also say that charter schools get lackluster results. A recent study by researchers at Stanford University found that about a quarter of charter schools studied achieved better outcomes on reading measures than traditional schools, but nearly a fifth of the charter schools did much worse. For math, an even greater share of charter schools were underperformers. Jack Schneider, an education expert at the College of the Holy Cross, puts it this way.
I think the evidence tells us that the best charter schools are exceptional schools, and that the worst charter schools are extraordinarily bad, and the vast majority of charter schools are more or less equivalent to traditional public schools.
Andrea Springer is about to test her luck. She's Korean-American and is considering sending her kids to the Korean Immersion Charter School in St. Paul that opens this fall.
We've stayed away from what I view as traditional public education, because I think as a child I was pretty either bored or just the teacher was dealing with behavior problems versus teaching us.
Even as charter schools remain controversial, demand for them appears to be strong. An advocacy group says hundreds of thousands of kids are on charter school wait lists. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
If you want to see how your state stacks up when it comes to charter schools, we've got an interactive map of that at marketplace.org. Coming up, cooking by computer.
With this system, you never have to try the same thing twice anymore. You could eat something different every day of your life.
Yum. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials neared another meaningless psychological barrier today. Tacked on 129 points did the blue chips, 0.75%, closed at 16,956. The NASDAQ also a banner day, up 50 points, 50 points, 1.1%, finished at 4,458. The S&P 500 ended things up 13 points, 0.67%, 1973. Not to give the action sports video camera maker any more publicity, but GoPro was up 16% today, now trading at $48 a share, double last week's IPO price. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for May. Expecting visitors? It's World UFO Day. Or perhaps you are planning your own trip. According to AAA, 41 million Americans are getting out of town between July 2nd and 6th for the Independence Day holiday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The June unemployment report comes out Thursday morning. Thursday, not Friday, as usual, because of the 4th of July holiday. It's a two-parter, as you know, this thing we call the jobs report. The number of jobs the economy added over a given month, and then the unemployment rate. You'd think it'd be a reasonably straightforward kind of thing, figuring out the percentage of people in the workforce who don't have work. Of course, this being capitalism, it's not. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Leslie Perkins is an HR management consultant who's been unemployed for about 3.5 years.
I feel forgotten and ignored by our society.
Perkins also feels ignored by the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics. It only counts you as unemployed if you've actively looked for work in the past 4 weeks. But Perkins isn't sure what that means.
Is it actually filling out a job application, or is it actually going to networking functions and trying to connect with people there?
I was confused, too. So I called Jim Walker, a Bureau of Labor Statistics economist. He says the Bureau will count you if you send out a resume as you're surfing websites or hand someone a resume as you're networking. People who aren't so active in their job search aren't counted in the official jobless numbers, but the Bureau still keeps track of them. Walker says they're labeled the marginally attached.
People who just say, well, I'm not working, I would want a job, but I'm not looking right now.
The Bureau gets its numbers by talking to real people. It surveys 60,000 households, asking people if they're working or looking for a job. Justin Wolfers is a labor economist at the University of Michigan. He says part of the confusion is you can be counted as unemployed even if you don't get an unemployment check.
One part of the government says you're not unemployed in the sense that they're not willing to pay you benefits. But another part says, no, we're definitely going to count you as unemployed.
Wolfers says the Bureau system isn't perfect, but it's about the best we can hope for because there is no easy way to measure unemployment. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
You've heard the phrase runaway production, yes? The growing number of film and television shoots being lured out of Hollywood and Southern California writ large, chasing tax credits offered by cities and states wanting a piece of that production pie. The stories thus far have mostly been about the shoots themselves, the actual filming. But the American Federation of Musicians held a protest outside the L.A. offices of Lionsgate not too long ago. That's the studio responsible for, among other blockbusters, The Hunger Games. The musicians are upset with Lionsgate for accepting millions of dollars in tax credits that let them do their filming in the U.S., but then let them score the movies overseas. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
Mark Sazer is a violinist. He's worked for decades in film and television as a member of the American Federation of Musicians.
The major studios that have longstanding relationships with the American Federation of Musicians, you know, Fox and Universal and Columbia and Paramount and Disney, when they produce domestically, they score their films with us.
Lionsgate is not considered a major studio. Technically, it's a mini-major studio. Sazer and the other members of the Musicians Union argue that Lionsgate is at the same level as the major studios. Last year, it generated $2.7 billion in revenue, millions of which came in the form of tax credits.
We're trying to bring attention to the fact that companies are taking our tax dollars and then taking our jobs overseas, which depletes our social compact, but it also depletes our cultural equity because it undermines the livelihoods and the sustainability of our musical culture.
In an outdoor amphitheater in the shadow of the San Gabriel Mountains, the Pasadena Symphony is tuning up for a rehearsal. Hundreds of empty chairs face the stage. Peacocks outnumber audience members.
And at this stage, we have about half of the orchestra on stage, some early birds, some will whisk in at the last minute.
Andy Malloy plays trombone in the symphony. He's also worked in film and television since he got his first gig on the Laverne and Shirley show. Malloy says film and TV gigs used to make up about 75 to 80% of his income.
I would say my guess, if there are 60 musicians here, I would say anywhere easily 40 to 50 of the people do recording work as well.
According to the union, total earnings of its members have fallen by half since 2007. During a recent protest, Malloy and his colleagues delivered a petition to Lionsgate headquarters. At the time, they singled out one film in particular, Draft Day, starring Kevin Costner. The score to Draft Day, which you're hearing now, was recorded at a studio in Macedonia called Fames.
My name is Laurent Copit, and I live in Macedonia, and with my partner and wife, Aud, we are running this studio that's called the Fames Project.
Copit's a musician himself, is originally from France. He was working at a classical music record label in Paris when he visited Macedonia for the first time.
And I discovered a country that was really interested in attracting investors and doing business, and they were very open to that.
Copit's got a loan, fixed up a recording studio, and auditioned more than 100 classical musicians. That was 6 years ago. Nearly all the jobs he gets are low-budget productions, accompaniment on pop albums, Bollywood films, and video game music.
You know, 99% of what we do is independent projects. Some of them turn famous.
Copitz was surprised when he came across the news reports that Fames was taking jobs away from American musicians. He says he can't compete with the quality of studios in Los Angeles, and that wasn't his intention. Copitz started Fames to make live orchestras affordable to those with small budgets who might otherwise use pre-recorded or electronic music. So when a low-budget production hires his musicians, that, he says, is an example of the good aspect of globalization. But if large studios hire him simply because he's cheaper, then, he says, they're coming to Macedonia for the wrong reasons.
When you go for the wrong reason, like, oh, it's cheap, it's not very nice for anybody because, yes, it takes the job here, which is a problem.
That problem, says Copitz, is the bad aspect of globalization. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
There was a day when all we expected out of our supercomputers was answers to our questions, lightning-fast calculations, complicated simulations, and winning Jeopardy in its spare time, of course. Watson famously did that, and now the people at IBM's Computational Creativity Project have taught him how to cook, to use all the trillions of ingredients available out there and design dishes that you would never have thought of, like a Bengali butternut barbecue sauce. Seriously. Florian Pinnell is the head engineer at the Creativity Project and, as it happens, a trained chef. It's good to have you with us.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. I will tell you, I am holding a jar of your Bengali butternut barbecue sauce. Had some last night with dinner.
Oh, what did you think about it?
Well, so honestly, I wasn't wild about it, but I have a 13-year-old who really liked it, so, you know, so that's good. But it was interesting because this is computer-designed food, basically, right?
That's right.
Explain to me how it works.
So we created this tool that we call Cognitive Cooking that helps people be creative and create new recipes that have never been tried before. Basically, you enter a base ingredient, and then the system suggests a number of cuisines, a number of dishes, and users eventually choose one of each, and we come back with recipe suggestions. We look at the trillions or quadrillions of possible combinations of ingredients, and we pick the ones that pair well with your inputs.
Well, I'll tell you what. So you look at the ingredients on the back of the Bengali butternut barbecue sauce, which... I didn't love it, but it wasn't terrible. Anyway, so this is a barbecue sauce, and the first ingredient is white wine. The second ingredient is butternut squash. I would submit that most barbecue sauces you get are going to have, like, molasses and sugar and water right up there at the top. So it's an interesting formulation, I guess.
So I think we had that idea to create a barbecue sauce for our event at South by Southwest.
Yeah.
And the system came back with a few suggestions. It said, you could try to put butternut squash in your barbecue sauce. And that sounded interesting.
It did not know you were in Texas, because any Texan would say you can't put butternut squash in a barbecue.
Well, the idea is to create something that's surprising, something that's never been seen before. So butternut squash sounded like a good candidate. And then the system told us that butternut squash is used in Bengali cuisine. So that's how it all started.
All right. Well, I get the Bengali now because I was a little confused by that. This enterprise of cognitive cooking is IBM's attempt to get creative, to show computer creativity. Why did you, though, pick the cooking part of this?
I think most people cook in their comfort zone, and they always cook the same things, always the same pairings of ingredients. And the computer doesn't have that bias. So it comes up with combinations that do work because we use a number of theories that tell us that they're likely to work together, but that you wouldn't think of.
What's the best thing you've seen Watson spit out, and then what's your least favorite thing?
Maybe one of the best things was a bacon and porcini pudding. It's both sweet and savory.
Mm, okay.
And I mean, that's something I would have never thought of. But you have that custard that's made with infused bacon and porcini mushrooms. And then you have a kind of cake that's crumbled off top. You have raisins, honey. It really goes well together, and it's really surprising. Also, I think that's interesting is that with this system, you never have to try the same thing twice anymore. You could eat something different every day of your life.
Hmm. Now that you've got proof of concept, right? I mean, it works, and even though I didn't love it, you have a marketable barbecue sauce here. Mm-hmm. Now what do you do? I mean, why? What's the higher purpose here?
What we're trying to do with Watson is try to understand what people expect from cognitive computing and, in our case, cognitive cooking. How can Watson help them make decisions, be more creative, answer questions?
Hmm. You could spin this out, right? And it's not just cooking. We could take it to a radio program. And we could walk in the morning and say, listen, we've got a 17-minute news hole, and we have reporters in Beijing, Kuala Lumpur, and London. What should we do?
Yeah, why not? I mean, it could come up with a compelling program that combines little subjects from various points of the globe.
Let's hope so. Florian Pinnell is the lead engineer at IBM Watson, their cognitive cooking project, from whence came today's main dish, I guess, Bengali butternut barbecue sauce. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which begins with the observation that today's U.S.-Belgium World Cup game arrived at a most inconvenient time, coming as it did just an hour before deadline here at Marketplace. But anyway, from the files of Intercall, a conference calling company, this little nugget, which we found on Quartz, conference call volume last week during the U.S.-Germany game, volume as in the number of conference calls, not volume as in sound, was off 11% just in that game alone. And also, to be honest, we were kind of lucky to get the show on the air today, but we did. And now we got to go. That's Marketplace for Tuesday. Nancy Fargali is our senior producer of special projects. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Shay Huffman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.